you know, I'm a little embarrassed that I have all these, especially little kids, and they come up to me and they go, oh, wolves are my favorite animal. You know, I've liked wolves since I was 2 or something. And I'm like, gosh, I didn't discover wolves till like my late 20s. I'm like, where was I? What planet was I on?
Welcome to In the Weeds with Nicole Asquith, exploring the way culture shapes our relationship to the natural world. In the last episode, we looked at Little Red Riding Hood and the cultural wolf, the wolf that's been passed down to us through generations of storytellers. This time, I talk about actual wolves with Maggie Howell, the director of the Wolf Conservation Center in South Salem, New York. The Wolf Conservation Center is a nonprofit organization that teaches people about wolves through tours and various education events. You can even camp out near the wolves. They also participate in federal recovery and release programs for 2 critically endangered wolf species, the Mexican gray wolf and the red wolf. We'll be talking about the unusual way they reintroduce wolves into the wild.
And they knew that there was one pack in Arizona that had pups around that same time.
When I visited the Wolf Conservation Center last winter, we were first ushered into a wooden cabin where we sat on benches, sipped apple cider, and looked around at the skulls and various artifacts. After a very interesting presentation, our tour guide gathered us outside, and before we headed onto the trail, she had us howl as a group. And then the most incredible thing happened. We heard the wolves answering us back. Through the woods, across the air, we could hear the collective howls in response to our own. And it was such an incredible feeling, such a visceral feeling of contact, made before you meet in person. And in fact, most of the wolves you actually don't meet in person, because the wolves that they plan to reintroduce into the wild, they want to keep wild, so they don't allow the visitors near them. But let's get to my conversation with Maggie Howell. I was looking at the Wolf Conservation Center website. By the way, I think you have an excellent website. And your slogan of sorts on the website is, wolves are worth saving, the environment needs wolves. So I was wondering if you could expand on particularly the second part. Why is it that the environment needs wolves?
Sure. So the wolf is, every animal has its purpose. The wolf is a little bit unique and special in that it's considered a keystone species. And so basically, if you think of architecture, let me think of an arch of a doorway. At the very top of that arch, you're going to see that special stone that's kind of a different shape, and it's called the keystone. And that's what holds the integrity of the arch itself, so it doesn't crumble apart. And that's kind of the role that the wolf holds in the ecosystems they inhabit. So basically, keystone species, they're not always predators. Usually they are predators, but they will have an impact, a top-down kind of trickle-down effect on the ecosystem. So really, one of the best examples that we've seen took place in Yellowstone National Park. And just to give you a little history, Yellowstone National Park, our first national park in our country, wolves were there historically. However, the last wolf was killed in the mid-1920s. So there were no more wolves left in the park. And without wolves, they saw a lot of different changes occur in the ecosystem of Yellowstone. And one thing that happened is wolves, they are carnivores. That means they eat meat, they're predators, and they like to eat animals like deer and elk, bison, moose. And without wolves, we saw really a boom of populations of these ungulates, these types of hooved animals. And because these animals, animals like elk and deer, are herbivores, they eat a lot of plants and trees. So in the absence of wolves, what started to occur is that a lot of plants and trees started being overbrowsed. And where we had vast forests, we now had isolated, like, tree stands. So a lot was changing just in the landscape because of this overpopulation of animals like elk and deer. And a lot of scientists who were studying the park at that time were really worried that the ecosystem was spiraling out of control. And they knew it was because the elk and deer populations were so high. So They tried actually to hunt some of these animals to reduce their populations, but that didn't really have much of an impact. But then in 1995 and 1996, when the political stars kind of aligned, the federal government reintroduced wolves into Yellowstone National Park and also into central Idaho. And when wolves returned, it was really the beginning of this new chapter for Yellowstone and the beginning of this rejuvenation of the landscape there. So the wolves first reduced the number of elk. That happened pretty quickly. But then what happened is they changed the way the elk behave. So no longer could elk just stand in the middle of a pasture and just eat all the grass or trees that they wanted to, because there was pressure, predator pressure, for them to keep on the move. Otherwise, they themselves could become lunch for a wolf. So by moving to different areas within the park during different seasons, but never really having a chance to stand in one place too long, it gave the plants and trees a chance to grow a bit. And now, gosh, for over 20 years now, later 30 years, we've really seen this complete rejuvenation, where not only did wolves impact the elk populations and the vegetation, but also, you know, animals like beaver, where the trees returned, the beaver came back to the park, beaver created dams, which was great marshland, excellent habitat for animals like moose that began to rebound. Songbirds started to return, fish, the grasses along the riverbanks had, there was shade provided by the vegetation, so fish populations were impacted, and really just saw this trickle-down effect where wolves were touching so many different species. And that is why the environment needs wolves.
Wow, that's, yeah, I had read about Yellowstone before, but it is really breathtaking to think about everything that has changed. So when you talk about the sort of degraded landscape that was there before they reintroduced the wolves, it makes me think about New York and the Northeast as well. A few months ago, there was an article in the New York Times arguing that the way to get rid of Lyme disease would be to reintroduce wolves in New York State. And I don't see that happening anytime soon. But could you talk to the ways in which the landscape in the Northeast is affected by the absence of wolves?
Yeah, you bet. So yeah, here in the Northeast, we haven't had wolves for about 100 years or so. And actually, you know, there was federally funded programs in the last century, really to rid the landscape throughout the lower 48 states of most predators, I think without an understanding of the ecological importance that some of them might hold. So really getting rid of wolves and cougars and coyotes was really a program that we were leading here in our country, just because we thought it'd provide more rooms for us, less competition for hunting animals like deer and elk, and also for our farms. So in the absence of these predators, we're obviously seeing a different landscape in the Northeast. And what's interesting is, you know, at one time, there was a lot more farmland in the Northeast than there is now. So there's been a few stages of transformation here. But what we see now in most areas is a place where it almost looks like, It's almost like a groomed forest. It looks absolutely gorgeous, but not to an ecologist. But you'll look through the forest and you see these, you know, big trees, but there's really not any underbrush, any understory below it. So you can see pretty deep into a forest in most places in the Northeast. And that's because the overpopulation of animals like deer are really going to be getting to all the saplings, all the things that were within their reach, and most of those are going to be gone. So really this important level of the woods is just something that we just don't have here anymore, that a lot of animals in different songbirds, you know, whether it's habitat or food, they're just not going to find it here. So yeah, it's really an out of balance landscape. And although we do have predators returning on their own, we do have coyotes living in really everywhere in the lower 48 states, really just spreading across North America. They're one of the most resilient animals that I've certainly ever known, especially since they've been just so persecuted, really, everywhere. Even people that love wolves don't necessarily like coyotes. But the coyotes that we have in the Northeast, they've gotten down into New York City. They've gotten to Long Island. So definitely they're an animal that's going to be here for a while. And they will have an impact, but they're not going to have the same impact that animals like wolves will. But there have been examples of a few wolves that have tried to return to the Northeast region. Unfortunately, all the evidence we have of those kind of recolonizing wolves as pioneers comes in the form of dead wolves. And because we have such liberal, I guess, coyote hunting seasons in most states in the Northeast, some states there's no seasons at all. Here in New York, we do have a season. A lot of the time these animals do get taken for coyotes and they are killed mistakenly. So we have had a few examples, though, of wolves getting into Vermont, also near the Adirondacks. So there is a means for them. It is very difficult for them to cross from Canada or even the Great Lakes states, but it is possible. So really what we would like to do is to make sure that people have the education to know what a wolf is, what it isn't, and also the state agencies can be prepared to afford wolves protection if they do have confirmations of those animals in any of our states here in the Northeast, and see what we can do just to promote their safety.
I wanted to talk to Maggie Howell about common misconceptions of wolves, starting with the most fundamental one. Inspired by stories like Little Red Riding Hood and many other stories in which the wolf is the figure of the consummate carnivore. So I started with the simple questions. Should we be afraid of wolves? Are they a threat to humans?
They're not a threat to humans. I'm trying to think of all the funny kind of silly things that have been compared to wolves as a bigger threat. You know, like I think more people get hurt by vending machines falling on them, I think, than...
Right. I that's actually in my promo piece about coyotes.
One of the only things that are like being on a ladder. But you know, wolves, obviously, you know, you always want to be aware of the wildlife around you and realize that we are a part of nature. So you can't just think we're above of nature and looking from the outside and how, you know, that we are a part of it and that we should be conscious of where we are and who we're among and what have you. So that all being said, wolves, though, are very shy and elusive creatures. It's one of the reasons why they're not very easy to spot in areas where they are living in the wild. One of the best places to see wild wolves is Yellowstone National Park, again. And a lot of that's because we're cheating, because there are biologists all over the park usually watching. And so you can just ask them. We have scopes probably set up all around the park. And a lot of those wolves are radio collared, so they do have people tracking them. So they know their general location and perhaps some of their behaviors as well, depending on the season, so where they might be traveling. So, but otherwise, you know, if you see a wolf in the wild, that's a pretty rare encounter because they do a pretty good job of staying far away from people. And what's interesting about that is, you know, why? Why would they stay far away from people? Is that something they just naturally know to do, or, you know, or is that something they learn to do? And what's interesting is that in the Arctic, where is the northernmost kind of gray wolf would live, the Arctic gray wolf, these wolves, and this is, you know, just based on observations from other scientists, but they tend to be a little bit more curious and also a little less fearful than wolves that are found, you know, down in other areas south of the Arctic. And it's probably because they don't get to see people very often. Really, the Arctic is a pretty vacant spot when it comes to our communities or any of our, you know, any sort of action with people. And so it kind of suggests that wolves have learned and passed that knowledge down that we're really kind of a scary, dangerous species to be around. So probably better for them to stay elusive and not be very bold around people. Because in the Arctic, they will actually come up to some of these photographers or some of these, you know, people working in weather stations and have you. They have these encounters with these very just benign encounters. They're just very curious. But it's really interesting to see because normally that would be such a rare and unusual behavior for a wild wolf. But they are very shy and elusive. And really the biggest threat, I guess, that could change that behavior to a wolf and perhaps make them, you know, pose some sort of threat would be disease, which of course is with all wildlife, things like rabies and what have you, the behavior is going to change within those animals, and they can become a bit more aggressive and definitely pose a threat. That or habituation. And that is when they get too used to people or they begin to associate people to food of some sort. So, and this is, I don't know if you ever heard, you know, a fed bear is a dead bear, but it definitely holds true that if you are feeding wildlife, often not only are you going to be putting people at risk of that, whatever species you might be feeding, but also that animal itself, because if that animal does pose a risk, that's when probably people are not going to tolerate it being in the vicinity. So, you know, things like just feeding animals or even like our garbage dumps can actually create a situation where animals can become habituated. I don't know if you've ever seen any of those pictures where you see like dozens of bears like hanging out at a garbage dump, but it's definitely a concern. But otherwise, wolves do a really good job at keeping their distance.
Are there other misconceptions that you've had to battle with in your job?
Oh, of course. Even if you open up the newspaper on any given day, you're going to see like lone wolf terrorist or, you know, the wolves of Wall Street or, you know, the insurance companies throwing us to the wolves or some sort of euphemism. And it's rarely a positive one and definitely rarely based on any sort of truth about wolves. So the only thing that I can think of that does hold some truth when I think of just in our culture, the way wolves are portrayed, is that wolfing down your food is something they definitely do. They do eat very fast and they can eat a lot of food in one sitting. But really just all the nonsense with, you know, Little Red Riding Hood or what you're seeing in most Disney films that involve wolves, it's really just fear mongering. And wolves are just, they're not villains, they're not saints, they're just another animal in the landscape, you know, living with their families, trying to survive, and that happen to have, you know, an important role in nature.
Since I knew that Maggie Howell had worked with other animals before she started with the Wolf Conservation Center in 2005, notably with big cats, I asked her if, when she started working with wolves, there were things she had learned that had surprised her.
Yeah, you know, I'm a little embarrassed that I have all these, especially little kids, and they come up to me and they go, oh, wolves are my favorite animal. You know, I've liked wolves since I was 2 or something. And I'm like, gosh, I didn't discover wolves till like my late 20s. I'm like, where was I? What planet was I on? But I really didn't. They just weren't on my radar for some reason. And when I was introduced to wolves and started thinking about how, wow, they're right here in our country and they kind of all this promise of recovery in different areas of our country happening right under our nose. I really just was kind of bitten by the wolf bug. And what I've learned continuously over the years is just how similar they are to people in that we both live in family groups. Family is everything to wolves. You know, really, I'm sure you've heard, you know, the strength of the wolf is the pack. We use that language all the time, but we tweak it a bit and just say the strength of the wolf is family. So it can resonate more with our supporters and people coming to learn about wolves. But really, it's all just about communicating with each other, the family bonds, working together and cooperation, and also competing with one another. And that would be with neighboring wolf families. So in the same way, we could have turf wars, whether it's, you know, on the grand political scale or maybe just in the neighborhood, wolves have that same sort of relationship and dynamic as well. So kind of like our faults and our strengths, you just see so much of one another with people and wolves. And it's hard though, for that reason, maybe that's why we have such a strange relationship with wolves and perhaps treated wolves so poorly in the past and also in the present. Maybe it's because we just see that direct competition. Maybe we're a little bit too much alike, but it's hard for me to see that disconnect where people could just think wolves are so terrible, especially when we have our such a passion for, you know, man's best friend, which of course is the wolf, Mother Nature's dog. Yeah, but no, really it's just the family and the communication, the traditions on these wolf families, what I have that are unique to each family group. You know, it's like if a family has a certain tradition they do in a holiday that they only know about, wolves probably have something similar too for them, not in a holiday, but you know, some part of their life. And it's just, I find that just really interesting and just really cool, but also tragic when you see, you know, a lot of these wolves, the indiscriminate killing of wolves, and you think of the families and the family traditions that might be lost. They might not have, you know, they don't have record keepers or photo albums kind of keeping track of all those things. And it's just tragic when you think about that.
So what is the state of wolves today? Let's just speak about North America. How bad are things? Is there hope?
Oh, yeah. I mean, actually, it's amazing if you look at the big picture with wolves right now, because, you know, 50 years ago, wolves were pretty much extinct in the lower 48 states with just a small population in the northern woods of Minnesota and maybe Isle Royal. Holding out, just a few individuals, but really nothing more. Where wolves historically have been in numbers close to 250,000 coast to coast. So that was 50 years ago. And in that time since then, or I guess about 70 years ago now, we've seen an amazing comeback. And some of it was done naturally, and some of it was done with the support of these federal reintroduction programs. All of it, though, the main tool that was really required to help facilitate this recovery is protection under the Endangered Species Act. So it's not until wolves were listed as an endangered species that they were afforded that protection and had a chance to recover. So that small population in Minnesota, it began to recover naturally. And wolves now have really healthy populations in Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan. Reintroducing wolves is what supported the recovery in the northern Rocky Mountain states of Montana, Idaho, and Wyoming. Now we have some of those wolves that are in Oregon, Washington, in and out of California as well, which is amazing. And also the reintroduction programs helped wolves that had previously been rendered or declared extinct in the wild to have a second chance by releasing ones that were in captivity, like the critically endangered Mexican gray wolf in 1998, and also the critically endangered red wolf in 1987, and giving those two species a chance back on the wild landscape as well. So if you look at the big picture, it looks great, but we've definitely taken a few steps backward, depending on different areas where you are. And so we just really want to keep the recovery, the positive recovery happening, and the animals that definitely need extra support to be rescued, which would be the critically endangered red wolf and also the Mexican wolves in the Southwest, to make sure that there's still the federal and state support for those programs, but also you need the community support as well. So we're just hoping that we can keep as many of these wolves protected as long as we can to allow that recovery to happen. And unfortunately, what's unique about wolf recovery compared to other endangered species recovery is that basically when a wolf is no longer has its endangered status and just becomes another species, it's recovered. That means that management of that animal is no longer going to be under the purview of the federal government. It'll be returned to state management. And sadly, so far, all states, when they're given that authority to manage wolf populations, they open hunting seasons and have reduced those wolf populations pretty much immediately right after they're declared recovered. So it's hard to celebrate recovery sometimes when you know that trophy hunting season for that species will follow within the same year.
Wow. That's intense. See, you mentioned the Mexican gray wolf and you had puppies born this spring. My daughter and I tuned into the webcam. It was great. I understand that one of them was more or less immediately introduced into a litter of wild puppies. Can you just tell me how that works, how you guys did that?
Yeah. So right now, so the Mexican gray wolf, first of all, is just the southernmost species or subspecies of gray wolf in North America. And they did go extinct in the wild. We did push them to the edge of extinction. The last 7 Mexican wolves were rescued from the wild landscape, put into captivity to basically rebuild their population in hopes that they would have a second chance to be wild on the landscape again. And that is what happened. So basically, though, the reason I'm going back and telling this is all Mexican gray wolves in the world, which there aren't very many, but they all descended from just 7 individuals. So genetics is always a consideration and a challenge with recovery for the Mexican gray wolf. And the wild population, which today stands at 131 in the United States, between the states of Arizona and New Mexico, right now they're genetically their equivalent of like brothers and sisters, which is not good. So really, we need to be able to rescue, a genetic rescue of this wild population. And so getting new genes out there is really a priority in the recovery program. So there's a couple different ways to get new genetics out there. One is just introducing, you know, adult wolves or family groups from facilities like the Wolf Conservation Center, which is what was done for quite a while. Right now, the states are more comfortable with something called these wolf pup cross fosters. And it is a pretty cool tool. We hope that they also will allow adult releases soon. But in the meantime, these cross fosters are, it's a pretty exciting journey. And what happens is when we have pups born at our facility, we immediately call U.S. Fish and Wildlife, who's a partner of ours in the recovery, and let them know how many pups are in the litter, you know, if they look healthy. And of course, most of this is done very quickly. These animals, we keep them as wild as possible. So they're very scared of us. So it's not like we just go in and, you know, cuddle and canoodle with the whole wolf family and their puppies or anything. It's definitely, they're terrified and we're looking at their pups. They're probably huffing at us, which is something they do when they're scared. But we went in and we quickly saw just our curator and our veterinarian. And they had to put a special microphone and a camera like on this long stick to even get down into this homemade den that the mother had stashed her puppies in. But we did confirm that we had 5 puppies. So we got back to U.S. Fish and Wildlife, and they knew that there was one pack in Arizona that had pups around that same time. They slated to do 12 of these puppy cross fosters for this past season, and they only had one more spot left. There were pups from other facilities that have already went, usually in groups of 3 or 4 pups per litter. So only one of our pups was going to be able to go, which made us really nervous too, because that just means they don't have each other to kind of be with, or even for the travel to keep each other warm. But our veterinarian and our curator, they looked at the litter, and at 10 days old, actually closer to 2 weeks old, their eyes were just barely opening, but they're teeny, like the size of, I don't know, an avocado. And they picked out a really robust little female to be cross-fostered into the wild. And so they actually had a private plane, a supporter of ours donated a plane, and our veterinarian and the curator and the little wolf, who we've since named Hope, got aboard the plane, flew out to the Southwest, met with U.S. Fish and Wildlife, and then went trekking through the wilderness to find this den with the wild wolf. And it happened to be very stormy in the Southwest at that time. And normally when people come around the den, if there are pups in the den, the adult wolves just scatter. They don't go very far, but they're scared enough of people that they will just leave the pups behind. And then they immediately go back to the pups once the people are gone. But because it was so stormy, the female, the mom, she wasn't leaving the den. So she was in there with her pups, her biological pups. And there was, you know, our team waiting to insert Hope, the little New Yorker pup, into the den. So they ended up basically dropping the little pup through a hole into the den and immediately saw the pup crawl over its new foster brothers and sisters and begin nursing with them. And we knew that was a really good sign. But really, so what happens is you're taking these captive born pups, inserting them into a wild den, and they are raised among the existing litter in there. The moms and dads embrace them, they raise them as their own, and you secretly kind of get their genetics into that wild gene pool without anyone being the wiser. So I don't know if Hope as a wolf will ever know if there's something a little special or different about her. A part of me kind of hopes she does, has a little bit of that New York moxie, but it's really just amazing to think that this wolf that was born, you know, here at the Wolf Conservation Center is right now living in the wild among her wild brothers and sisters and moms and dad and aunts and uncles, and hopefully going to get that opportunity to help bring, you know, the ecosystem back to balance there. So it's really just such, she's such an inspiration And it's been a successful program. So we are just going to be sitting on pins and needles until, I don't know, we might not ever know. But if she's ever captured and collared, we will know that she survived. But right now, in all of the reports, they do reports because they do have collared parents in the pack, that the pack's all together and everything looks good. So we're really hopeful.
Thanks for listening to this episode. I hope you enjoyed it. Thanks to Maggie Howell and the Ambassador Wolves, Zephyr, Alewa, and Jack from the Wolf Conservation Center, who lent us their howls. Once again, please leave us a positive review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen, and tell a friend. I appreciate it.